The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong speaking to you from Brussels, the capital of Europe. The capital of Europe, did I say? Yes, that's exactly what Brussels is being called. It was the term used by President Ford at his arrival here at the Brussels airport, following his greeting by King Baudouin of Belgium and the Secretary General of NATO, Joseph Luntz, whom I had the privilege of interviewing yesterday morning. How close are we now to a prophesied United States of Europe? That is a very, very serious question, with portent for the United States beyond anyone's ability to really comprehend. Europe, right now, struggling through so many different organizations, so many open-ended committees, so many attempts in so many directions, whether the European Coal and Steel Community, whether Euratom, whether NATO, whether the many, many organizations within the framework of the European Economic Community, is struggling very, very hard for some kind of cohesiveness, some kind of unity. A very little understood, little heard of committee or organization inside Europe is the European Parliament. Most Americans have never heard of such a thing as a European Parliament. But in brief, this body is the Parliament consisting of individual members of the parliaments of all of the 9 member nations of the European Economic Community. In short, a Parliament member of, say, Britain, elected by the public, who would be a member of the British Parliament, or his counterpart, whether in West Germany, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, even in Ireland, or perhaps in Italy, would be selected by that Parliament to represent that Parliament in this European Parliament. And so the European Parliament also has been formed as another one of these entities here inside Europe, aimed towards some kind of solidification, some kind of union, some kind of cohesiveness, which would eventually become a united Europe. Within the European Parliament exists a political affairs committee, and they have selected just 1 year ago the rapporteur, as he is called, to draw up a plan for a unified program on the effects of a European foreign policy as it relates to defense questions. The head of that organization is Lord Gladwin, who is a member of the British Parliament. And Lord Gladwin, over a period of a year, has drafted up a rather lengthy resolution which is going to be presented to the European Parliament and then sent to the respective parliaments of all the 9 nations of the European Economic Community in very short order, setting forth proposals for a common European defense program. At the summation of his report are the factors A, B, and C, which have to do with his assessment of the current condition in all of Europe, in the light of developments in the Middle East, in the light of developments between the Warsaw Pact nations of the Soviet-dominated puppet states of Eastern Europe, or the light of recent withdrawals from the United States power position in Southeast Asia. He says, under subhead A, that members of the community, that is the European community, might be content to let their forces remain more or less at their present level, not to improve or standardize their existing array of defensive weapons, and justify such an attitude on the assumption that the Americans, for reasons of self-interest, will continue to maintain indefinitely both their troops in Germany and their so-called nuclear umbrella. He says, however, that that would be absolutely dangerous, in his view, for such an assumption on the part of the European community. Secondly, he talks of neutralization, and he says the European community could go further and maintain that there is, in principle, no further use for NATO or for the Warsaw Pact, and that the best thing would be to work toward the creation of a demilitarized zone between the Rhine and the Oder, guaranteed by both the superpowers. Yet, on the other hand, Lord Gladwin says he believes that would be virtually disastrous to even contemplate that. He is setting forth the various alternatives, then, of any meaningful defense posture for these nations of Europe. Third, he says, in a completely different mood, they might begin to build up a European nuclear force, both strategic and tactical, under unified command, which combined with the necessary conventional weapons would result in the communities becoming independent of any outside support whatsoever. As he points out rather poignantly, without really underscoring the desperate, almost desperate need for the creation of such third force, when he calls the first possibility dangerous, that is, let things go as they are at the present level, neither improving nor standardizing the existing array of weapons, and trusting basically on the American nuclear umbrella. When he says the second, that is the creation of a demilitarized zone between the Rhine and the Oder, would be literally disastrous. And then he holds out the third alternative of the creation of a third nuclear force, and says this at least would be impossible for several years in the future. He nevertheless very obviously points up that the only really alternative eventually for these European countries is the creation of a third force in the world. For many, many years on this program, I have been saying that eventually your news would be concentrating almost exclusively on the Middle East and on Europe. And the reasons I have said this is simply because of what Bible prophecy says is definitely going to happen inside Europe and in the Middle East. The very focal point of all world attention is soon going to be right here in Europe. We have said for literally two decades on the World Tomorrow program that a United States of Europe is eventually going to come. And permit me for a moment to reminisce about those early years when I first became a part of the organization that is now global, and when I was first back home out of the Navy in 1952. My father, years before me, was saying eventually there would come a United States of Europe. He was particularly paying a great deal of attention to Germany and to what would be a miraculous post-World War II economic and industrial boom. Almost no one believed that that could occur. As a matter of fact, some of the top diplomats in the entirety of the world said it could literally never occur. Anyone who had visited West Germany in those days immediately following World War II might have concurred with that opinion. Sir Winston Churchill said West Germany would never rise. They never talked of West Germany. They usually just said Germany, even in spite of the fact that Germany was now totally divided and that Berlin, a city completely surrounded by communist-dominated East Germany, was in itself a divided city. But they gave it a very minimum of 50 years. There were those who called any such idea, such as the resurgence of Germany, the revitalization of German industry, the powerful economic base that Germany would finally represent, they called those ideas insane. Nevertheless, this program, standing out amongst all the others like a literal voice in the wilderness, continued to proclaim through all of those years that a very powerful, revitalized Germany would begin to dominate in Europe, that it would absolutely begin to become one of the most important items in your news and a very deep and serious concern to the United States. Well, you are presently living in those days. Taking a look for a moment at Europe as it presently exists, let's just understand that these very powerful nations, if they are taken singly, do not represent but perhaps a portion of the strength of the United States. But nevertheless, when you view them all combined, that is not only the European Economic Community, but any other nations inside Europe which might eventually become a part of the third power bloc, then they represent a community actually bigger than the United States, a community of about 250 million with economic and military potential beyond that of the United States, with one exception, and that is in the nuclear arsenal. But when you look even at those factors, you can understand perhaps that that could shift very dramatically simply because existing inside Western Europe, and most of them deployed inside West Germany, is the backbone of the nuclear arsenal of the United States of America. There are about 1,000 nuclear warheads in Europe, most of them deployed inside West Germany. And everyone knows that the West German Defense Force, as it's called, represents the most powerful military organization inside Europe, outside of the Americans themselves. So the gradual creation of a third power bloc in the world is very definitely underway. While today there are many rather disembodied organizations all seemingly scrambling around in no certain direction within the framework of many different European organizations striving to bring about some kind of European unity and with very limited or small success, nevertheless, the feeling and the mood is there. The desire is there. No, the necessity is there. The questions that I am asking European leaders on this current trip have primarily to do with the archaic posture of NATO. I'm presently out of doors, by the way, in a public plaza right across from the headquarters of the European Parliament, and I'm seated out here in a very pleasant little park with passers-by going by in all directions and Brussels traffic busily scurrying by just in front. And right here behind me are a number of little sparrows, so if you hear any birds cheeping in the background, you'll know exactly what's going on. But at any rate, the realities, the political realities that Europe must face today have essentially to do with energy, with economy, with agriculture, with global geopolitics, and with defense. With regard to energy, Europe knows that 90% and more of her energy supplies must flow from the Middle Eastern oil fields and those of North Africa. If we go back just a very short period of time to the Yom Kippur War, you will all remember how totally vulnerable those vital sources of energy supplies are. For instance, even though there is the framework of the European Economic Community, and even though there are the members of NATO, the 14 as opposed to the 9, yet during the energy crisis following the Yom Kippur War, when the Arabs decided to cut off the flow of oil to Europe, each nation went it alone. Each individual country entered into bilateral arrangements or agreements with Arab oil producers based upon, basically, the alteration of such nations' foreign policy toward Israel. You'll recall that West Germany came in for special raps across the back of the hand from Arab oil-producing states simply because it was known widely that the American F-4 Phantoms were flown, that bombs and ammunition and even other types of weapons such as tanks, machine guns and the like, whatever had to be supplied, was taken out of some of the American arsenal over here inside Europe and was transshipped from German bases. American Air Force aircraft lifted equipment and supplies into Israel during the Yom Kippur War from bases in Germany. The Arabs, of course, knew this, and so they retaliated by cutting off the flow of oil. You knew, too, that there was a special amount of irritation on the part of the Arab states toward the Netherlands, who continued to ship fuel to the United States, continue to transship refined fuel from, for instance, Shell Oil, which is a Dutch-owned company. And so there was a total embargo imposed upon the Netherlands by the Arab oil producers. So this lesson has not been forgotten here in Central Europe, which depends almost 100%, clear upwards of 90, 92, 95% and more for its energy supplies on the Middle East. Now, when you take a look at the archaic configuration of NATO, that NATO is basically facing toward the Warsaw Pact nations, that NATO forces are basically drawn up in Central and North Central Europe, in West Germany primarily. France, you know, virtually pulled out of NATO, is literally, though a token member, not a viable member of NATO at all, and even one of the NATO headquarters moved, which is precisely why they're here in Brussels, Belgium, and not in Paris any longer. The other members, of course, want France to come back in, but France at the present time doesn't appear willing to do so. So the French wanted NATO headquarters out back in 1966, and from that time the French have been pretty much going it alone. There is no real standardization of arms. NATO in itself is not all that cohesive. There is a great deal in this report by Lord Gladwin of the European Parliament that states NATO is in fact archaic, that its troop and armaments deployment are not realistic. I think you, as an American citizen or Canadian, could easily understand that by simply noting that the NATO forces primarily are drawn up facing the Warsaw Pact forces across the line right in a divided Europe. But the soft underbelly of Europe is exposed. Not only that, but some of the weakest members of NATO today are the rival nations of Greece and Turkey. Now, Greece is pulling out of NATO, as you know, is withdrawn, and the two nations have completely severed diplomatic relations with each other. So it is very, very likely at some time in the future that you're going to see some of the hottest spots in all of the world, right in the very softest, southernmost and easternmost flank of the NATO nations, which is in the Mediterranean and the Middle East, and they are not prepared either by policy or deployment of troops and weapons to deal with such a crisis, should it occur. I have here with me a gentleman who I met in the United States when he came over to Ambassador College about 2 years ago, Guy Van Haverbeke. And I'd like Mr. Van Haverbeke to explain to our American and Canadian listeners exactly what is the European Parliament, what his position in the European Parliament is.
Thank you very much. I remember fondly that time I had at Ambassador's College in Big Sandy, Texas, and as well as in California. At that time, I was already a civil servant of the common market. However, I was serving the executive branch of the common market. Now, I'm still a civil servant of the common market, serving the parliamentary arm of the common market, if you wish. And there is this European Parliament, which is composed of delegates of the national parliaments of the 9 member states of the common market, and it operates very broadly like a parliament. However, it has not yet all of the powers of the national parliaments. There is a gradual shift of competences and powers from the national parliaments to the European Parliament. For one, the European Parliament is not composed by directly elected members. The direct election of the members of the European Parliament is scheduled to take place only by 1978.
So the present manner in which the European Parliament members are chosen is precisely what? Is it a matter of each individual member of the 9 selecting its own delegate?
Exactly. Each individual national parliament has its own procedure to send its delegation to the European Parliament.
And what is the function of the European Parliament? What literally does it do?
It does very broadly what the national parliaments do at the national level. There are a number of areas, as you very well know, that do not belong anymore to the area of competence of the national states, such as trade policy affairs, agricultural policy affairs. They are not decided anymore in the national capitals of the member states, Bonn, Paris, London, etc. These areas are decided upon by a set of quasi-federal institutions at European community at common market level. And whereas the decision-making body are essentially an executive commission and an executive council of ministers, the parliamentary branch of our institutional setup is this European Parliament, which has to be consulted on all of the areas where the common market institutions take decisions about.
What would be the interplay between the European Parliament and its Political Affairs Committee and NATO, for example? Presently, I understand that Lord Gladwin has been studying the effects of a European foreign policy on defense questions and is advocating a unified procurement program, for example, the selection of a body which will deal primarily with the armaments to be delivered into the hands of the various NATO forces. They want standardization. Could you explain a little bit of the interplay between the European Parliament and its suggestions or advice, and how that relates to NATO forces in Europe?
If we want to answer your question in a very restrictive manner, we should say, well, the European Parliament is the parliamentary branch of a common market which is only competent for economic affairs and which can only work on the basis of a rather restrictive economic constitution, if you wish, which is the Roman Treaty. Hence, the European Parliament can only deal with these strictly economic matters. However, the European Parliament is a political body because it is composed by, if I may risk that expression, political animals, who, of course, are not satisfied with a limited role and who individually see the interplay that exists between the economic problems they have to deal with and with political affairs. Hence, they have an ambition for themselves and for the body in which they sit that also political problems should be dealt with. And the example you give of Lord Gladwin examining that problem of armaments and relationship to defense and so forth illustrates perfectly what I mean. There is an ambition among the European parliamentarians to broaden the scope of their work behind the strictly economic affairs.
Lord Gladwin says there are basically 3 things which he says might or could occur. The first being that the NATO nations could stay exactly as they are, allowing their weapons to gradually deteriorate as they aged, and not really become a viable force that would be improving itself. The second would be the creation, which is very unrealistic, of a so-called demilitarized zone, hoping that the Warsaw Pact nations would abandon their defense posture, that NATO would abandon its, and he says this is utterly unworkable. The third would be the creation of a third nuclear force. Basically, he hopes, I would imagine, the use of both the British and the French nuclear arsenals, and perhaps even the creation of a third European nuclear arsenal. He says this is impossible for the foreseeable future. So alternative one, he said, would be dangerous. Alternative two, he says, would be disastrous. And alternative three, he feels, could not occur for many, many years in the future. In your own personal view, what do you feel is the likelihood of the creation of a third nuclear force in Europe?
Well, this is really a very personal view indeed. I much rather see Lord Gladwin answering that question with much more competence than I could. I think that in the immediate foreseeable future, there is no alternative for Western Europe, and by the way, for the United States itself, than sticking to a system of defense which has proved to be extremely successful. I mean by that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The Atlantic Alliance, indeed, has achieved all of the goals for which it was established. And I think we should not forget that. We have a tendency to say that, there is detente and there's no need anymore to stand on our toes as it used to be. I think personally that it is not because we do not have had a fire during 20 years in our house that we must give up a fire insurance just like that. I think we all are in favor of detente, and I think we all are in favor of diminishing the risks of confrontation. But this has to proceed very gradually, and I think that since we have that extremely useful and successful tool, which is NATO, we should not just speak loosely and lightly about giving it up without knowing exactly where we're going to, and nobody knows exactly where we're going to so far as other, in terms of other alternatives.
Don't you believe, however, that with detente and with the very fact that there has been no major brush fire of any proportion significant to be threatening to the entire North Atlantic Treaty Organization, even though there was the brutalization of Czechoslovakia, there was a Hungarian rebellion that occurred in this long period of time, that presently, given the present world conditions of the very turbulent situation in the Middle East, of the very vulnerable energy supplies which must flow to feed Europe's vital energies or industries here, that that NATO is a little bit unrealistic in that it has no real defense policy, or it has no foreign policy, neither does the European Economic Community per se, which is directed primarily toward the Middle East and which is directed primarily toward the Arab oil producers.
Well, of course, the NATO organization as it exists today is still very much along the pattern that it was set up when it was established. And it is a matter open for discussion as to adapting it to new circumstances.
Do you think that will be discussed during the NATO summit conference? It's just a guess, of course, anyone's guess.
Today and tomorrow in Brussels, I hope our leaders will be realistic enough to tackle these problems, because I think, as you suggest, that they are vital.
I would hope that they would begin to think about that soft underbelly of Europe exposed to growing Soviet influence and domination in its fleet units in the Mediterranean, also the opening of the Suez Canal, and also the very weak flank of Turkey and Greece.
What you ask me now is crystal ball glazing. I have not the agenda of the heads of state and governments who are now deliberating in the NATO headquarters only a few miles away from here. I suggest we will get and we will know more about that tomorrow and the day after tomorrow.
We at least hope that they will tell us what they're deliberating about privately. The first NATO meeting in the NATO headquarters is at 4 p.m. just this afternoon. We just heard the clock strike 11, and I'd like to draw an analogy to perhaps we are literally at the 11th hour for Europe and for the United States to tidy up the situation right now, to in some way reassure our European friends of American commitment and resolve, if that is possible, where at the middle echelon there may still be a great deal of doubt in the wake of Watergate and Vietnam. But certainly we're living in very historic times, and with a complete reappraisal or reassessment of American foreign policy abroad, I think we're going to see a reassessment of European and European Economic Community and NATO policy as well.
Yes. However, when we speak about reassessment, I personally, who have stayed 5 years in the United States and just came back from there, hope that the American reassessment will take into account that there are absolutely brilliant success stories in the American foreign policy, and I think that the European chapter of the American foreign policy has been a success story. So whereas I understand the drive for reappraisal of other chapters of American foreign policy, I personally hope that the European chapter of foreign policy in the United States will be reappraised with caution.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Guy von Heverbeke. We're talking with Mr. von Heverbeke, who is the information counselor of the European Parliament. And I'd like to again say that I doubt very much that the average American or Canadian even knew that a European Parliament exists. Yet it does, very much alive, very active, has its various committees studying the problems right now current inside Europe. I think it's quite appropriate that we address these issues on the very day that the NATO Summit Conference is underway here in Brussels. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Armstrong, and I wish you a further excellent trip and study visit to Europe, and come back very often.
Thank you, sir. Well, that's about it for this time from Brussels, Belgium. You've heard the voice of Guy von Heverbeke, who is the information counselor for the European Parliament. We're going to be over at NATO headquarters again a little bit later for the arrival of President Ford and the beginning of the NATO Summit Conference. Meetings have been underway here in Brussels all last evening and through this morning among NATO leadership. Again, I say, if you want the true overview and to keep really up to date and abreast of world happenings and how they relate to you where you live, especially in the light of Bible prophecy, then you need to get your name on a mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine. All you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.